Hello and welcome everyone to Masterclass this Thursday, September 21st, 2023. So glad to see everybody. I'm going to put the bot out also, but first I want to put in the chat the agenda for tonight. That didn't work. Because that's not my list. All right, I'm going to hold anybody up because we do have quite a few. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 7 presentations this evening, and I'm telling you, they look so good. I cannot wait to get started on them. So we're going to start with Ahmad. If you're ready and you want to go ahead and start the presentation.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So I just hit the share button, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Pop in. Tell me if here we share the screen. Can you guys see my screen?
Yes, I can.
Okay. And go in here.
Rebecca, your camera's on.
Okay. Let's present.
I see you. I don't know if I'm seeing you or someone else, but there you go.
I hate when that happens.
All right.
All right.
Beautiful. I see it.
So my topic I chose today was going to be cryptocurrency and solving real world problems. My name is Ahmad Alosa. A little bit about myself. I come from a multicultural background, bilingual. I also speak Arabic. I'm 24, and I reside in Ohio. I've been here pretty much all my life. I'm loving the experience with Purdue Global University. And definitely this program has taught me a lot in the making. With the internship. So with the topic I chose for today, a little history on it. I was actually 13 when I ran into Bitcoin, the heavy hitter, the most popular at the time. Well, actually not at the time, but currently now, the most talked about. And I was actually at the PayPal screen ready to purchase about, I want to say 500 Bitcoin. And it was like, I believe around $20 or $30 or so trending. But I did not have a credit card to put in at that age. And my neighborhood best friend, Brian, was the one who brought it to my attention as well. So we both begged our moms to just purchase at least 100 Bitcoin, but they thought it was a scam. So that's kind of what I guess inspired me to make this presentation to inform more people and about cryptocurrency and what it can do and change in the real world, I guess, that we see today. So that's going to lead me into my second slide. So we got cryptocurrencies. So for beginners that really don't know anything about it that much, cryptocurrency is a decentralized form of digital or virtual currency that uses cryptograph for security. It operates on a technology called a blockchain, which is distributed ledgers enforced by a network of computers called nodes. Unlike traditional currencies issued by governments, cryptocurrencies are not regulated by central authority, making them immune to government interference and manipulation. Bitcoin, introduced in 2009, was the first cryptocurrency and remains the most well-known, as I mentioned in the past slide. But thousands of others, including Ethereum and Ripple, have since emerged. The value of cryptocurrencies can be highly volatile, as we can see today in the real world market with the crypto trading. It can go and come down and do whatever it wants, really. And their adoption and usage continue to spark both enthusiasm and speculation globally. So I guess it's too new for people to really jump into, and it's just unstable at the moment. But hoping down the road, people can start developing cryptocurrency. Like, I've, for example, seen an Ethereum ATM at a Circle K gas station, of all places. That kind of blew me away to see, oh, wow, like, it's hitting the scenes quicker than I thought. So with my particular idea, I'd like to actually give people and the government sort of half and half power within the cryptocurrency itself, maybe making some kind of conjoint system where it's not all the way government and it's not all the way outside of the government. So it actually plays both ways and it can mix in nicely. And this would actually increase job security for what I'm doing right now with crypto or with cybersecurity. And this could enable two-factor authentication or 2FA and other features down the road. It can even might even incorporate face IDs, PIN enabling, passcodes, all that, encrypting, biometrics, because then that data needs to be safe as well, which will land more security for the cyber side and more jobs on that end. So on to the second slide or third slide. The problem right now that I've seen would be American homelessness. The Department of Housing and Urban Development counted around 582,000 Americans experiencing homelessness in 2022 alone. So with my solution, because I kind of have a similar kind of thing going on, just at a smaller scale, there's something called network mining versus the old Bitcoin farm mining, which took so much power and electricity that the bill alone for some of those farms would be in the millions, maybe a quarter of a million, but they would get a good return also on that. But it would be detrimental to the environment, which also wouldn't be a plus in solving that issue. So I would come into play with making a coin or a token called e-real estate coin mining solution plan, and it would be like a piece of legislation that I would hope could go into some form of local government or local Congress, if you will, some sort of city scale even, for halfway homes, retirees, like elderly places, anything of that nature, and it'd be in little units. So these miners are about the size of a Wi-Fi router. I own two currently at the moment, and I've played around with them. They're not per se hard to design or create. It's pretty basic standard hardware and motherboard type deals with a network attached to it. So everything in this plan is feasible. I would just need the people to back it up and the government to basically adopt it. And this would cut, I believe, homelessness in half, just because of how mining can basically help the individual in the homes be in there, first off, because then it would pay itself back and don't have to worry to make ends meet as a normal average American. This would cut that virtual solution in the real world situation. And here I have a video of a little bit of an example of mining, just for anyone that's new into the game and haven't really looked into it as much. I think it was a good summary of it. It's a minute long. Let's go ahead and play that.
Oh, I forgot to say you need to turn on your computer sound when you're sharing, because we can't hear anything.
Let's see. It's showing it's on. Can you hear that?
No, it's within the share itself when you go back into share. So unshare and then share again. And at the top right corner, there's, what's it, use computer sound?
So, okay. Stop sharing.
Right.
And then include computer sound. Yep. Right
yep.
There.
There you go.
How are we looking? We got it. Can you guys see my screen?
Yes.
Okay. Cool. Let's redo that real quick. This was the Bitcoin mining farm, the old-fashioned one. Still running in some other places, but that was what
I was referring to. Yeah, I wish I had bought into it. We had an intern, actually, who bought into it, like $10,000, and I'm wondering how he's doing now. About $10,000 at the prices that you were talking about when it was really, 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 really low at the beginning.
Yeah.
Probably five
yeah.
years ago.
Exactly. And I was blown away when I saw what it's worth now. So
I was like, dude, I'm not getting into that. So stupid.
Right. All right, here we go. For the second time.
All right, here's your 60-second rundown on how crypto mining works. Every 10 minutes, there's a new 6.25 Bitcoins that are awarded to one of the miners. Now, the miner that actually receives this reward of 6.25 Bitcoin is based on a math problem, and whoever can get the closest to or can actually solve this math problem is the miner that will get rewarded with the Bitcoin. Now, if you purchase a Bitcoin miner, you can run it on your own and you can try and be the miner that solves the equation to win this major reward. And 6 Bitcoin is a big payday. However, the odds are very low because you're competing on your own against all of the other miners in the world. The other option here is to pool all of your mining energy together with a bunch of other miners and then split the rewards and pay yourselves out on a steady basis. This is what I have chosen to do, and as of right now, I'm making about $3.30 every 4 hours. So far, we've mined about $3,600 worth, or about 0.09 Bitcoin.
All right. Just how that video basically explained. Essentially, you can put it in a pool, and that's what I was...
All right, here's your 60-second rundown.
That's what I was kind of referring to with the mining. With the e-real estate plan. And I would see that to be very beneficial because at a massive scale, with at least, you know, 250,000 people with each unit for those miners, like that individual was talking about and explaining, that $3 an hour could easily be $100 an hour at any given moment. And the more people that join in and conglomerate on a pool, the better the chances for, you know, a homeless individual to be still in these units. And they would just have to provide basically participation that they're living there every month or bi-weekly or annually or whatever. And that would be the only thing they would have to present. And they can still live almost, if you could say, rent-free at that point, because they're just, their existence is paying for their rent. I feel like we can, as the world is changing more digitally, I would see that being an option. And then, like, if you go to New York, there's some, like, crazy outlandish priced apartments for no reason, the space the size of a shed, and that could easily be at least toe-to-toe competition with the e-real estate cryptocurrency plan. So essentially, make a deal with the government, run housing and assisted living areas like before. This would be like kind of the checklist for me. Start making the very first e-real estate cryptocurrency. Go after that. Obviously, you know, wouldn't take us like 10 steps. Make the actual Wi-Fi router size official real estate crypto miners. Have them come out of the press essentially with the motherboards and antennas, all very cheap parts. Plug and participate. That would be for the individual that needs a home at the moment. I mean, I've seen so many people living in their cars at like only at the age of 22. It's kind of crisis mode right now. This could present a relief at least, or some kind of roof over the head, if you will. Have all the miners and these special homes contribute to multiple mining pools and stakes. And I'll continue with that in another slide on pools and stakes, because that's a big part of it as well, to support the project altogether. Have all the major exchanges support swap and keep all the data safe through cybersecurity protocols, which I'm already learning currently. So that would be beneficial down the road to incorporate for this plan. And here we go. We'll go to the next slide here. So before I run the second video, I got a summary of staking and pooling for this project in general. And it goes like this. Cryptocurrency staking pools allow multiple coin holders to combine their resources to increase their chances of validating new transactions and earning rewards and proof of stake, POS in short. Blockchain networks, validators are chosen to create new blocks based on the number of coins they hold and are willing to stake or lock up, as individuals, some holders might not have enough coins to compete with large stakeholders, excuse me. But by pooling their resources, they can increase their collective staking power. Participants in the staking pool share the rewards promptly based on their contributed stake. So essentially all that means is the more the pool, the better and solid the stake is, versus having these farms and pulling out as much as, I don't know, like I said, 250,000 in electric bills. This would be a solution to that. And again, way better for the environment. And each home can carry one, just plug and play, simple. Create legislation or paperwork related with government, like WIC, food stamps, if you will. They can even take that and make it into those kind of assistance. Easy to track, I would think, real time. It could be better than this system today. It might need an update or two, but again, anything government related takes a good minute to, I guess, be on the trends, if you will. So long term, I could see it working out. And here would be the video to further explain it. Again, it's a minute long. Not too much, not too crazy.
Proof of stake is an alternative method of creating blocks in a blockchain compared to proof of work. In proof of stake, the block producers are called validators instead of miners. Validators must put down a deposit or stake in order to participate in the process of block creation. In proof of work, miners compete to create a block simultaneously, and the first one to produce a valid block is the winner and gets the block reward. This is usually the party with the most computation power. In proof of stake, validators are chosen based on some selection algorithm that takes their stake into account. Once a validator is selected, they have the exclusive right to create a block. The other validators are not wasting energy doing any computational work since they are not selected. This will dramatically reduce the energy consumption compared to proof-of-work mining and is much better for the environment. In addition, if the validator misbehaves, then they will lose their stake. This gives the validators the incentive to behave honestly.
That was basically the summary of what I was referring to in video form. And we will move on to the second or fifth slide, I believe. If I can, or sixth slide, that's fine. If I can, let me do that. Okay. So then this will be my sources that I've gathered and my own personal experience as well with it. And I really see high hopes in this evolving, whether it be pushed slowly or aggressively. Again, we see almost cars driving themselves. I mean, what's next? You know, this is probably like Tesla's up on its top, on its peak. Everyone's going Tesla. The more I'm on the roads, the more I see them. Again, ATM, Ethereum. Cryptocurrencies ready to withdraw. So this could be very well in the making. Again, it's all on paper, but that shouldn't matter because all it takes is a little push and some networking, and it could be very much here today and to stay, as we see today in the real world. And that would solve homelessness, essentially, as one of the beneficial routes. And it could be almost like in the movies where you don't need to come up with the classic ends meet for rent or wherever you're at. And this could very well change the real estate market as well. Like, there's so many things that could happen with this. Crypto basically is the beginning and not necessarily the end. And that concludes my presentation.
Awesome. Awesome job.
Thank you.
Does anybody have any questions for Ahmad? Yeah.
Ahmad, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Hey, Matt, excellent presentation. I was going to ask, do you think the train's pretty much left the station as far as crypto, or do you think it's still kind of possible to get in?
I think it's still there, definitely. We just had our first early wave with Bitcoin. That was kind of the trial phase, and that's why it's so volatile today. But once something solidified hits and there's actual people on board and there's, like, again, good real world solutions with it, like you can see it, like how I saw that ATM, Ethereum ATM, like that kind of blew me away. That's basically the beginning for me. I would say that would be the second wave and could be more waves after, but that would definitely be a good sign and the right step, if that makes sense. So definitely not dead, but definitely not forgotten.
I think the pricing of the Bitcoin right now, it's really hard to get into because of the pricing of it. If you're going to buy a Bitcoin, it's huge, it's tremendous.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But there's new ones. I don't know about the new ones. There's one, the dog one, and or the
Dogecoin and altcoins and ECRN coins.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it could very well be Bitcoin could retire, essentially. You don't really need to jump into that. The next one that could hit everyone's homes, like quite literally with this like solution I was thinking of with homelessness and the network mining, could be the next coin. Like it could be called e-real estate coin. And then next, you know, everyone's on board because they're loving it, because everything is more simplified and less hassle-free, which everyone wants these days. That's the goal.
My view on that is probably it'll be big in the cities, but I don't see it happening in the countrysides, because there's so many people who don't understand it and don't trust it that it's really not going to be like national or nationwide. You know what I mean?
Right.
Unless it's forced on them, I don't see it really getting too far. Homelessness problem is really something that I wish it would work for. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, that could.
That's for sure.
Have so many benefits alone and in those urban cities and areas.
I think the biggest question is how do you get, once you have those and your money's put into these Bitcoins, how are you supposed to get that money back? And I guess you were saying if it's something like an ATM, that would work. The people are trying to buy stuff with Bitcoin, and it, you know, there's a lot of places that are not going to use Bitcoin, then you can't buy it.
Right. There would definitely have to be some kind of on-hand, like, kiosk, if you will. Like, Tokyo, for example, I have tons of kiosks for everything, vending machines of sorts. And that would be the new bank teller, if you will.
Right.
So, yeah, it's revolutionary. It's new, and it could hit at any moment. Like, when I saw that. And I was in a fairly rural area as well. Like I was blown away when I saw that. I wish I took a picture and put it in the slides, but I didn't think of it that way. But it's still there currently. So, and I just did my registration, and that was fully automated on a kiosk as well, like a BMV kiosk. I didn't have to speak to anybody. So I guess it could very well be the next thing, very next thing. Yeah, so.
Right. Well. Excellent job. Like I said, it's great.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you for your guys'
time. Good topic to bring up. Definitely. A lot of information. Thank you.
No problem.
All right. Aaron, are you ready? Aaron, I see your bubble, but I don't hear you. Your mic's open, but I don't hear you. You might be double muted. You're not muted in Teams. I have to shut these off. Yeah, it could be your headphones, or it could be on your system. You might want to go out and come back in. Sometimes that gets shut down. Input output. Tell you what, why don't I go ahead and do Tyler's recording while you go out, come back in, and see if that helps. Try that. All right. Let me. Do this. All right.
Alrighty. Good evening, team. This is my masterclass presentation. It's called Securing the Internet of Things, Challenges and Solutions, a presentation on IoT and cybersecurity. My name is Tyler Sadler, and I am wrapping up my associate's degree program, and I chose to focus my masterclass presentation on IoT technology because it's something that's fascinated me throughout my studies so far, especially the aspect of security. So I'm going to be covering that tonight. I got a lot of content, so I'll try to skip around and keep it as to the point as I can and stay with under the 15-minute mark because there's a lot to cover. I took a lot of notes, so let's begin. So the agenda for tonight, we're going to be covering the introduction to IoT, some applications of IoT, security challenges in IoT, IoT security best practices, some real-world examples of the data breaches or just overall negative effects of IoT technology that have been publicized, some of the future trends of Internet of Things technology, and a conclusion. I'd like to start off the presentation by quickly just giving an introduction to IoT technology. I think at this point in our educational careers and just the overall situation of where we all live, we're pretty familiar with IP-enabled devices. I mean, they're all around us. But just for the sake of the presentation, by definition, the Internet of Things refers to the network of physical objects or things that are embedded with sensors, software, other technologies, allowing them to collect and exchange data with other connected devices and systems over the internet. These objects can be everyday items like household appliances, industrial equipment, vehicles, wearable devices, and more. The Internet of Things holds immense significance and has experienced remarkable growth due to its transformative impact on various aspects of our lives and industries. And out of those aspects, that would include enhanced efficiency, cost savings, improved quality of life, safety and security, environmental impact, healthcare advancements, industry growth, connectivity, data insights, and innovation. Next, I'm going to be covering some applications of IoT technology, covering commercial and industry, as well as home and residential. So for commercial and industrial, we have examples of smart buildings like lighting, heating, ventilation, HVA systems, security systems, asset tracking. Good example of this would be like for Amazon, they have asset tracking technology where they can figure out where their vehicles are or just like company property, things like that. Environmental monitoring, inventory management, energy management. Point of sale or POS systems. I mean, you can go into pretty much any mom and pop shop now, and they've got some kind of advanced POS system, like a Clover or Square Ready device, and fleet management. As far as in a residential setting, these are very common too. You see smart homes, thermostats, lighting systems, voice assistants, home security, cameras, doorbell cameras. These would be like your Rings, your Nest cameras, things to that nature. Health and wellness, fitness trackers, smartwatches, home automation, energy savings, entertainments, your Googles, your Alexas, things like that, home assistants, and remote monitoring. Next, I'd like to spend some time covering some of the security challenges with IoT technology. So out of these, we have data privacy concerns and device vulnerabilities. So starting with data privacy concerns, we have data collection and surveillance. So IoT devices such as security cameras and smart home assistants continuously collect data about users' activities and behaviors. And this data may include audio, video recordings, which can be drawn on an ethical line of intrusive if not handled responsibility. Along with this, we have data security, data ownership, data sharing, consent and transparency. So obtaining informed consent from users for data collection and sharing can be challenging, especially when the terms and conditions are buried in lengthy agreements. So we also have data retention, data profiling, cross-device tracking, and that means IoT devices, when used in conjunction with each other, can enable cross-device tracking, allowing companies to build comprehensive profiles of users across multiple devices and platforms, as well as inadequate security updates and legal and regulatory compliance. And now touching on device vulnerabilities. So the first one is weak authentication. Many IoT devices ship with default usernames and passwords that are rarely changed by users. Attackers can easily guess or brute force these credentials to gain unauthorized access. Secondly, inadequate encryption. Thirdly, lack of security updates. Four, unencrypted firmware. We also have open ports. So open network ports on IoT devices can provide entry points for attackers. We also have insecure APIs, application programming interfaces, that allow for remote control or communication. If these APIs were to lack proper authentication or access controls, they can be exploited by attackers. We got default services, physical access, as well as a vulnerability. So attackers can gain physical access to IoT devices, may be able to manipulate or compromise them. Firmware tampering, denial of service attacks, insufficient authentication for updates, insecure communication, no user interfaces. Some IoT devices lack user interface for users to configure security settings, making it difficult to implement necessary security measures. Default device identifiers and supply chain attacks. Next, I want to talk about some attack vectors with IoT technology. So firstly, we have weak authentication, device firmware vulnerabilities, insecure network services, man-in-the-middle attacks. I'm sure we're all probably familiar with what that is at this point. Packet sniffing, which we should be familiar with as well, with our studies here at Purdue Global. If you're in the IT internship program using Wireshark, things like that. RFID spoofing or RFID or radio frequency identification, physical access or gaining physical access, DNS spoofing, eavesdropping, DOS or DDoS attacks, malware and ransomware, social engineering, we all know what that is, supply chain attacks, botnet recruitment. So attackers can compromise vulnerable IoT devices and use them to form botnets, which can be used for various malicious purposes, including launching DDoS attacks. Zero-day exploits. So attackers may discover and exploit previously unknown vulnerabilities in IoT devices, which there are no patches or fixes available. And lastly, Bluetooth and Wi-Fi attacks. IoT devices using Bluetooth or Wi-Fi may be vulnerable attacks targeting these communication protocols such as Blueborn or Crack attacks. Next, I want to talk about some security best practices when using IoT technology. The first one being strong authentication. So there should be unique credentials used, like a combination of username and password to prevent attackers from gaining access. Multi-factor authentication, which is very common now today. Almost everything requires some form of MFA, as well as device authentication, digital certificates, secure tokens, things of that nature. So secondly, encryption. So you should be implementing data encryption to data both in transit and at rest using strong protocols like TLS or SSL for communication between devices and backend systems. End-to-end encryption is always a possibility. As well as this, you just want regular software and firmware updates. So make sure you provide regular software and firmware updates to patch known vulnerabilities and improve security. Always implement automatic updates when available. Thirdly, and the last one here on this slide is, fourthly, is access control. So you could implement RBAC or role-based access control, assigning different levels of users and devices based on their roles, practicing the least privilege principle. And this one applies specifically to like a commercial setting. You could conduct vendor assessments. So requesting information on how vendors are testing the security of their devices and software. This might include like vulnerability assessments, pen testing, code reviews, third-party certifications, and also vendor response to vulnerabilities. So understanding how vendors respond to security vulnerabilities, and a responsible vendor should have a process for promptly addressing and notifying customers about vulnerabilities. No, and there that is. Next, I would like to provide some real-world examples of where IoT technology has experienced failures. So the first one would be the Mirai botnet 2016. This was responsible for one of the largest distributed denial-of-service attacks in history, infecting thousands of poorly secured IoT devices, including cameras and routers, and using them to launch massive DDoS attacks against internet infrastructure. This attack ended up disrupting internet services for millions of users. The Stuxnet worm in 2010. This one was not exclusively an IoT breach, but it targeted industrial control systems, including those in IoT devices, such as programmable logic controllers or PLCs. Next is Jeep Cherokee in 2015. Security researchers demonstrated how they could remotely compromise a Jeep Cherokee's IoT connected system, including the engines, brakes, through vulnerabilities in the vehicle's infotainment system. And this breach led to a recall of 1.4 million vehicles. You got a smart refrigerator. Let's see what was going on with that one. Just issues with the IoT technology on that one. Hotel room door locks. Security researchers discovered vulnerabilities in IoT-based hotel room keycard systems. They were able to exploit these vulnerabilities, gaining unauthorized access to hotel rooms. Baby monitor hacks. This is something that I've heard about in my own studies as well. There's been several instances where attackers gained access to baby monitors, allowing them to spy on and even communicate with infants. These incidents raise serious privacy and concerns. Smart camera home breaches, medical device vulnerabilities, and most recently, Ring doorbell privacy concerns. I wanted to just briefly show some IoT security standards that are out there in today's environment. I went into pretty good detail on my notes here to go into them, but I can see due to time constraints, I'm just going to have to go over them pretty quickly. So you can see them listed here on this slide as far as standards and regulations and compliance and certification. So in order to hit all the content here under 15 minutes, I'm going to go ahead and move to the next slide. Next, I want to touch base on some future trends for IoT. So firstly, we have artificial intelligence and IoT and IoT security. So we could be experiencing AI-driven insights, increasingly leverage AI and machine learning to analyze data locally or in the cloud, enabling real-time insights and decision-making in automated IoT systems, as well as predictive maintenance and natural language processing. As far as IoT security as well with that, we can see enhanced device security, an automatic adoption of zero trust architecture standards, security standards and regulations, which I kind of touched on in the previous slide. You saw the example of it, and security analytics. Secondly, we could see more blockchain for IoT. So IoT device identity, data integrity, smart contracts, and supply management. And lastly on this slide is the more adaption of 5G network and IoT security. So that would include low latency communications, network slicing, and massive IoT deployment. 5G could facilitate the deployment of massive IoT networks with a vast number of connected devices, and that would be a huge need for IT security solutions on IoT for that large-scale deployment as well as private 5G networks. Enterprises could possibly deploy private 5G networks for IoT applications requiring tailored security measures to protect these dedicated networks. And I would like to just briefly go over to educating users. So educating users moving forward in IoT is crucial to ensure that they understand the importance of security, as well as the privacy, and know how to use IoT technology safely. Here's a list of just some of the strategies for educating users. So we would see clear user manuals and documentation, in-app tutorials, user-friendly security settings, regular updates and reminders, privacy notices and consent, privacy modes installed on more devices and technology becoming a main feature, using strong passwords, multi-factor authentication, and regular device audits. And in conclusion, this is just a list of everything that was recovered on this presentation. So the Internet of Things has revolutionized connectivity with applications spanning industries and residential environments. However, it also poses security challenges. To address these, robust practices like strong authentication, encryption, updates, and vendor assessments are all incredibly vital. Looking forward, AI, the use of AI, blockchain, and 5G will define IoT's future. With AI enhancing IoT intelligence, blockchain secures identities and data, and 5G offers rapid connectivity. User awareness always remains critical, as in any aspect of IT. Educating users about safe IoT practices is key to unlocking the IoT's potential while mitigating risks. And as IoT evolves, proactive security measures and collaboration are essential for a secure and prosperous future. And that is it for my masterclass presentation. Looks like my time is now just hitting 17 minutes, so I apologize for going over by two, but I had a lot of content that I wanted to cover, and I had to skip around to meet the time constraints. So I just wanted to thank everybody for listening to my presentation, and I'm sorry I couldn't be here to give it to you guys in person, but I work pretty early in the morning, so it's important to me to be able to get some sleep sometimes, and I just get see after a while. So hope everybody has a great night. Thank you very much to Marjorie, the vice president of PGIP Tech, and everybody who makes these meetings possible. And I wish everybody luck. Thank you, and have a great night.
Thank you so much. Excellent job. Excellent, excellent job. You did great. That was just great, and I'm saying that because, you know, he's going to be watching this, so I just wanted him to know this is an excellent job. Perfect. Exactly what I'd like to see, and such a great topic, too. And it was funny because at one point, I won't say her name, Ellie, started talking. So you talk about IoT, and you talk about this stuff as it goes on, and sometimes it's just out of nowhere, she's talking, and like nobody said your name. It's the same thing with the goo word, you know? I mean, these things go off and they start talking to you. That was great. Perfect. All right. So we've got Aaron. How's it going? Are you able to do this? To do yours now? So you're not muted on our side. It's got to be on your side. How's it coming, Aaron? Checked out Renatest, so I'm not sure what's the problem the last 2 weeks. Great. Thanks for coming, Jason. Issue the last 2 weeks. So have you unplugged it and plugged it back in? You know how that goes. Well, it might be that you did when you did it, did you restart your computer or did you just get out of the meeting and come back in? Because you may have to restart your computer for the whole driver thing and everything to work. We can go on to the next presenter in the meantime. Which I believe is Steven.
Yes, that is me. I believe I'm ready to go.
All right.
And can you see my screen?
Yes.
Perfect. And here we go. Welcome, everyone. My name is Stephen McCarthy, and welcome to my presentation on the MGM and Caesar cybersecurity breach, which by everyone but MGM's account is still ongoing. Our objectives tonight will be to go over the attackers and victims, timeline of events, the incident and its impact, as well as remediation, how this could have been avoided and how it could be avoided in the future. And then we'll wrap up and questions, and I also threw in a little real-time update slide with some stuff I found just this evening afternoon. There are two attackers and two victims. Attacker one is the Scattered Spider Group. Their industry label is UNC3944. They have many aliases. A couple are Roasted Octopus and Storm0875. They're reported to have been active since May of 2022. They are financially motivated groups, and their tactics are many, including Telegram and SMS phishing, SIM swapping, MFA fatigue, voice phishing help desk, and security operation centers, as well as spear phishing. In summary, they're more of the intrusion-based attackers. They do recon, exploitation, et cetera. And that brings us to attacker two, which is Alpha. I believe that's how it's pronounced. I'm assuming the V is supposed to be a cute little upside down A. They're basically ransomware for hire / sale. They provide ransomware as a service. They are reported to be active since November 21 and very active at that. They're reported to be responsible for 12% of ransomware attacks in 2022, which seems significant to me. Here is a little snippet of a, I guess you say it's, could say a written lashing they gave MGM during this while they set the record straight and took claimed responsibility for this attack, or at least partial responsibility. They wrote, "The tactics, procedures, and indicators of compromise used by the people they blame for the attacks are known to the public and are relatively easy for anyone to imitate." We will get into that there, but basically we are going to show some gross negligence on the part of MGM. They also, in this post on a dark web leak site, claimed to have pinged MGM engineers multiple times with no response. They claimed to have reached out in other ways, but never able to receive a response. And then they accused MGM network engineers of lacking an understanding of how their own network functions. And to me, this is possibly a reason why MGM is still lacking functionality, while Caesars seemed to never miss a beat. Which brings us to our victims. Victim number one, a little less known, Caesars Entertainment. They have 51 resorts globally. They have resorts in 10 states, Canada, and Dubai. Some of note are Caesars Palace, Paris, Las Vegas, Planet Hollywood, Flamingo, Las Vegas. And their revenue from June of 2022 to June of 23 was $11.417 billion. In case you're wondering, that equates to an average daily revenue of $31.279 million. So, not peanuts. Which brings us to victim number two. They don't have as many resorts, just 31 globally. Much more prominent ones, though. If you notice any on the list, MGM Grand, Mandalay Bay, Aria, Bellagio, Luxor, and I include the MGM Borgata in Atlantic City because I wanted to remind myself that even though this was affecting mostly the MGM in Las Vegas, the Atlantic City location was reported on Monday, September 10th, to have its casino floor completely empty, although apparently they did still have guests in rooms. Their trailing 12-month revenue is $14.82 billion, which is an average daily revenue of $40.6 million. Now, I bring this up because we're going to get to incident impact in a minute, and I think paying the ransom would have just been a really smart way to go. So, we're going to go over a quick timeline of events. And I want everybody to keep in mind that this is a very current event, so it's a little convoluted and complicated. All information has not been published yet, as you will see further in my presentation. And there seems to be a lot of conflicting information, as, you know, seems to be the par for the course these days. Anyway, so a basic timeline of events is: on Thursday, September 7th, Okta, which is a third-party help desk vendor used by both Caesars and MGM, or Caesars Entertainment and MGM Resorts, is a victim of a phishing attack where the attackers obtain login information from the vendor. They're reported to have done this by getting employee information off LinkedIn profiles for MGM and Caesars, and convincing Okta to send them password resets. I would assume they spent the weekend going rooting through the victims' networks, and on Sunday carry out ransomware attacks against MGM and Caesars. I would also assume that this Sunday night is about the time that Caesars pays the Scattered Spider Group $15 million ransom, because come Monday morning, Caesars is fully operational and MGM is in shambles. And by many accounts, is still recovering. So let's get into the incident and its impact. We'll go over Caesars Entertainment first because it is much simpler. They reported that 6 terabytes of data was stolen from their loyalty program database. And they paid a $15 million ransom to, one, get access back to their systems and networks, and two, get a promise from the hackers to not make the stolen data public or sell it on the dark web. I'm going to read you a little excerpt from their SEC 8K filing, which is for reporting a breach. As a result of our investigation, on September 7, 2023, we determined that the unauthorized actor acquired a copy of, among other data, our loyalty program database, which includes driver's license numbers and or social security numbers for a significant number of members in the database. We are still investigating the extent of any additional personal or otherwise sensitive information contained in the files acquired by the unauthorized actor. We have no evidence to date that any member passwords, PINs, bank account information, or payment card information were acquired by the unauthorized actor. We have taken steps to ensure that the stolen data is deleted by the unauthorized actor, although we cannot guarantee this result. We are monitoring the web and have not seen any evidence that data has been further shared, published, or otherwise misused. They also acknowledge they're doing the standard issue 2 years of credit monitoring and identity theft protection, as well as a website and number you can use to contact and find out if your information was compromised. So that seems to be the extent of the Caesars side of the incident. As far as we can tell for now, it's surely going to cost them a lot of money, but they seem to have handled it pretty well considering they were infiltrated. So let's get to MGM Resorts. So as we know, there was the phishing attack against the third party help desk vendor Okta. They then used these credentials to access the system, and they compromised over 100 of their ESXi Linux servers. And at that point, MGM Resorts decided to unplug their entire network, which you might wonder why they decided to do that. And you will come to see that when you don't segment your network, you have to pull the plug on the whole thing, and the results are disastrous. Okay, so here is some of the impact to MGM Resorts. The websites of all 31 of their properties are offline. Guests are locked out of hotel rooms, slot machines are out of service, hotel phones aren't working. They have analog hotel check-in and check-out, which is leading to hours-long waits. Cashiers and ATMs are unable to dispense cash, which is obviously vital for a casino operation. And this is funny. At one point, guest room could be opened with any room key. So apparently, since they were using electronic room keys as part of the loyalty rewards app, and that was down, and they had a disaster and decided it was a good idea to give some people master keys so they could get into their rooms, and these people found out they could get into other rooms, and the dominoes just keep falling. So how did this compromise happen? It's all about the ESXi server. So basically, they got access to the network, and then they, through lateral movement, somehow were able to access device and credentials to query the vCenter for server names. The vCenter is a virtual center to manage the servers. And then you also have the ESXi management interfaces, which are supposed to be used for troubleshooting. Apparently, they got SSH credentials for those as well. They then used, so they're on port 22 over SSH. They use secure copy to transfer their ransomware files. Presumably, they formatted them into a binary Linux-readable form first, and then they log in with SSH on the ESXi management interface and execute their ransomware files, as well as stealing whatever data they can find. So the details of that have not come out yet, but that's what I have come up with so far. And the problem with all that is remediation or stopping this from happening should have been fairly easy. So they didn't segment their network, as I mentioned earlier. They should have isolated their ESXi servers and server management interface by creating a subnet. They should only allow access to this interface from the subnet. You shouldn't be able to access from the regular network subnet. That's terrible. They also should only have SSH console access by administrators, and probably only on a couple of pre-approved hardware devices. I can't imagine that needs to be done from anywhere at any time. Not to mention, the interface is only for troubleshooting, so it doesn't need to be turned on at all times. It could easily be turned off and turned on when troubleshooting is needed. And it also would appear that they are not monitoring access attempts to this management interface, because otherwise it seems unlikely that they would have been able to compromise over 100 of them before MGM was able to stop them. And obviously, you would think that they would be using multi-factor authentication for such vital resources. So, why is this important? Appears we have gross negligence on the part of MGM, which I'm sure will continue to come out as we move forward. But they obviously lacked standard and simple security practices. They didn't respond to the hackers. I would have strongly recommended that they just pay the ransom when you're doing $40 million a day in revenue. You just give them $15 million and deal with the rest later. But they didn't. I also just checked around 8:30 tonight the MGM's SEC 8K filing, and it is virtually empty, especially compared to Caesar's. They have like two sentences in there, and it's nothing. And MGM is also reporting, as of yesterday, they are back to normal, fully operational, but employees and patrons state otherwise. And the result of this has to be a massive loss of revenue. So, a little real-time update with this. Things I just threw together about 30 minutes ago. As I said, they claim operations are back to normal, but there's plenty of evidence to the contrary. Their electronic room keys and rewards app still doesn't work. Cashiers can't perform all usual services. And employees are reporting that all of their information is stolen. So all their 401k, their bank info, their social security numbers, their families, if they have them, on their insurance, etc. And there is also no comment from MGM at this time on whether or not they paid ransom. So this is honestly a disaster that seems like it could have been very easily avoided. And I hope the full truth comes out as time goes on. There are my references. And are there any questions?
So there's one question in the chat. After a breach, how likely is it an organization would be apt to let go of their IT employees?
That is a good question. I would assume, if this negligence is as bad as it appears to be, that they would have to get rid of all the security engineers involved with this situation. We also have the problem that the entry into this was because of a third party vendor. So that is another problem that needs to be addressed in and of itself.
Yeah, because it starts with them.
But at the same time, I'm not sure how you can fire employees in the middle of a disaster such as this, because that requires interviewing, hiring, onboarding, and training new employees while you're trying to mitigate the damages.
Definitely won't get bonuses at Christmas.
Yeah, that, that is certain.
Wow, that's rough. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, they did say that they contacted MGM Engineering and nobody contacted them back. Nobody replied. So
yes, and I wanted to go and read the entire post that they posted, but it was on the dark web, and I was a little hesitant to, just go perusing and make myself vulnerable like that.
Yeah.
But they said that they I read some things. So they were on a dark web chat, and there was someone from MGM there lurking, because they were talking about all of this. It might have been on this same blog. And they were like proving to him, this person, like, hey, we have all of this information of you guys. We have your executive's username and passwords. Like, reach out to us. We want to negotiate. And the person and the user never said anything, never respond, never replied, just lurked there. So there's a lot of questions. After doing this hours of research, I have more questions than answers, to be completely honest.
Yeah, I'm sure they do too. how could this happen? But, the smarter option was to go ahead and pay the ransom. You get everything back, and then you get somebody who specializes in this stuff and locks you down so it doesn't happen again. And obviously, this is something that's going to happen more and more. You know, as we saw, it's happened with gas. It's happened with water. That's just within citywide. It's going to happen to more and more companies that are not only nationwide, but globally like that. If they are not locked down like they should be, they have a lot of money. It's going to happen again. Mm-hmm. So.
You have to pay the price, because MGM and Caesars were in the same situation. Caesars paid $15 million. They resumed normal operations the very next day and continued to make their $30 million a day.
Which is nothing for them for a whole year. That's nothing. They can write it off at the end of the year anyways.
Mm-hmm. And so MGM is in the same boat. They're going to have to pay for all these things. They're going to have to get their network locked down. They're going to have to reimburse customers and stuff, pay for their identity protection and all that.
Well, yeah.
But they also lost probably 2 weeks of revenue.
Yes. And customers. The clientele, they're not going to go there anymore. They're going to take all their information out of whatever online and everything. They want their money back. And yeah, they're not going back. They'll go to Caesars next time.
Yeah, right.
They'll go to MGM. Makes me double think that too. Well, that was great. That was awesome. Very good.
Excellent. Thank you.
All right, Aaron, how you doing? We've got others. I mean, we can just keep moving you on if you can't get in there. Did restarting your computer and everything, did that work? Did not work. Well, there's no worries. What you can do, I mean, you're going to need a mic to do it, but you can narrate it and then send it to me, and that way it'll be done, and then I can go ahead and present it at another time. If you want to do that. Because, of course, I don't want you losing the credit. You're not going to lose the credit if you get it to me. But you will have to narrate it, so you'll have to figure out your mic. And it could be just, you know, something with Teams. So it probably will work, but not in Teams. I don't know how that's going. So if you want to do that. I think so too, Stephen. Yeah, it is definitely going to be one of those biggest disasters. Absolutely.
Maybe not as big as Equifax, though, unless the MGM exec sold all their stocks over the weekend.
That's true. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, Teams or Windows, it could be. All right, not a problem. We will go on. In the meantime, I'm going to find my list. All right, who's after Josh? Are you ready?
I think so. Can you guys hear me?
I can.
Awesome. All right. Let's see. All right. Hi, everybody. I will be doing my presentation on human embedded technology. So what is human embedded technology? Human embedded technology essentially is a type of tech that is embedded surgically. It's embedded or surgically attached to the human body. Humans have been wearing technology for a while now, and with the rise of smartwatches, rings, glasses, etc. I guess the only logical step forward would be to attach technology to the human body. So human embedded technology, or biohacking, as others may refer to it as, again, is the next step forward. And the purpose of it is to enhance performance, productivity, or health. So, and that would be the definition there. So, you know, just like other types of technology, these devices need to be connected to the internet. So to get into that, we have the Internet of Bodies. So Internet of Bodies is an ecosystem of technology, very, very similar to the Internet of Things, but contains devices used to monitor the human body and collect biometric data. So Internet of Bodies contains technology that a lot of us are familiar with, such as wearable health trackers, you know, smart devices and things like that, but also contains technology that is typically only seen in like science fiction. So some of these include the brain interfaces, or brain computer interfaces, and body implanted sensors. So to get into that a little bit more, a brain computer interface is a type of technology that connects to the brain directly with electrodes. So this type of technology, I guess, has the potential to write entire or type entire words directly from the brain, and even has the ability to control prosthetics. We have also body implanted sensors. So these are tissue integrated sensors used to provide precision bio tracking capabilities, and even the ability to remotely control other devices. I have the future of human embedded technology. So human embedded technology to many is the work of science fiction, but it's becoming a reality day by day. In fact, human embedded technology has been around for a few years now and can even be traced back to 1998, when the first human implanted microchip was installed. One of the most controversial and easiest implementations of human embedded technology is the hand embedded payment chip. So this has been coming up a lot in the news lately. You'll see people be able to control or be able to pay for things with essentially just a swipe of their hand. And that's, you know, with a microchip kind of inserted into the palm of their hand. So like I said, this type of chip allows for users to pay for items with only using their hands. And there's also many other great examples of human embedded technology, which also helps people either completely or, you know, just helps them overcome their disabilities. So the benefits of human embedded technology, main purpose and benefit of human embedded technology is to improve the performance of the human body and provide more convenience to the users. These implants can provide the user with the ability to pay using their hands and even open doors. Technology can even help users with certain disabilities or health conditions to be able to do day-to-day tasks more easily. They're already being used, like I said previously, to monitor certain ailments and monitor functions of the body. So the negatives of human embedded technology, you know, human embedded technology has a lot of potential and many advancements have come in the recent years, but the technology is hasn't completely normalized today and isn't completely accessible to everybody. Because of this, there are some major security and ethical concerns. Technology is fairly new and still needs some time to develop. So we have the impact of cybersecurity. So this technology has been around for a few years, but it's technically still in its early stages. That doesn't necessarily mean that it has any effect or it has no effect to our security. There is a massive potential for this type of technology, but the potential can be negative as much as it is positive. So I have the good and bad, you know, impacts to cybersecurity. So positive impacts, we have, it can be used to open security doors and, you know, some of them can even hold small bits of information or data. This can be used to more securely implement physical access controls and, you know, obviously store important bits of information with trusted users. This makes it more difficult for the information or key access to be lost or stolen. Bad side for security would be, like I previously stated, it's not really proven to be secure or efficient enough, especially with a semi-permanent installation of the devices. This type of technology still has some maturing to do, and it will most likely take a long time before it is viable. It's a viable option for most people. So this brings me to what do we know? I guess kind of one of the main vulnerabilities that we do know of is one that we're, you know, very familiar with in cybersecurity now, and that would be NFC. So a lot of these devices use near field communication. And obviously that comes with, you know, their own vulnerabilities. So NFC, again, is a type of wireless communication technology. It's very commonly used in payment methods such as credit cards and phones. Three of the main vulnerabilities that I found with NFC devices are eavesdropping, which is, you know, one of the biggest attacks that can be done to this type of technology. And unfortunately, it's not very secure against it. This would require an attacker to be close enough to one of the NFC devices to be able to intercept the connection. NFC devices typically work by having an active and a passive device. Depending on whether the device sending the information is in active or passive mode would determine the distance and ease the attacker would have to intercept the data. An active device has a, you know, the data can be intercepted from a distance of 10 meters away, while a passive mode device will require a distance of 1 meter away. So next one would be data tampering. So this occurs when an attacker is able to gain access to an NFC device and reprogram it to send data back to the attacker. A relay attack. So finally, a relay attack would be an attack that occurs when a threat actor is physically near the communicating devices to pick up and transfer the data to another device. So this is very similar to eavesdropping. The main difference would be sending that information to another, like a third device, essentially. So how do we mitigate these risks? One of the best ways to ensure that data is not easily intercepted by is by making the sending device work in passive mode. This would effectively mitigate the risk of someone being able to eavesdrop the communications. Not only this, but the NFC device should also be able to check radio frequencies while transmitting information and stop the transmission of data in the event of an attack. Fortunately, data tampering and relay attacks can only be performed under special circumstances. A relay attack can only be performed if one of the devices supports card emulation. Data tampering, like I said, is very similar to eavesdropping. So the best way to mitigate that would be to ensure that the data is also or the device that's sending information would also be in passive mode. So in conclusion, human embedded technology still has a long way to go before it can be adopted by most people, but I predict that this type of technology is the way of the future, and it will require stronger implementation of security, like all other forms of technology that's connected to the internet. It's important that we take the necessary steps to ensure that this technology is viable and secure for everybody. And then I have my references here. Does anybody have any questions?
I'm talking without my mic. Excellent job. Great.
Thank you.
Good topic. Wow. Just a lot to think about. I've always thought about that. I'm thinking, I thought the chip in hand would be the card that we use constantly, but I've heard about the chip in hand.
Yeah. I mean, I've definitely been seeing it more and more like on the news lately. It's, I actually saw there's a group of people out there who kind of do this stuff in their own home. So they have like some like weird like in-house surgery, I guess, kind of surgery procedure, like some people will implant magnets, RFID tags and things like that into their body. It's definitely a community that's very small at the moment, but it's starting to grow, and some elements of it are being picked up by the mainstream right now.
No. Nope. That's all I got to say. Nope. Oh my gosh. It's getting crazier out there.
Absolutely.
Well, that was great. That was a very good one. All right. Gary, are you ready? Got two left. Gary and then Jose, who did just leave us.
Marjorie, can you hear me?
Yes.
I had to get my safari hat for my presentation. I am as ready as I'm ever going to be.
Okay. Did you need me to share the presentation, or you're sharing it?
I think I should be able to share it here.
Okay. All right.
Let me see if it. Can you guys see the Terminator bot?
Yes.
Excellent. Intro mode here. Oh, okay. I think I can just do it that way. All right. I thought you guys could actually see the other slides. All right, guys. Good evening. My name is Gary S. Jones, and I am presenting. This is actually a multifaceted presentation here, kind of on several businesses that Elon Musk is working on. Mainly, it has to do with the Neuralink project. And SpaceX and the Tesla bot. In the words of the character Cypher in the film Matrix, as he was talking to Neo, buckle your seatbelt, Dorothy. Kansas is about to go bye-bye. Now, what does the 1980s Elon Musk brain implants, androids, Mars have in common? Good question. The future of humanity. So I'm going to start by hitting on some fiction from, some would say, the greatest decade in recent history, the 1980s. Neuromancer, considered one of the most classic sci-fi fiction novels, introduced the concept of cyborgs, implants, in a futuristic society. This was released in 1984. Great classic films in American culture. I've highlighted two of them here, Blade Runner and Terminator. One had to do with a advanced AI and a assassin cyborg that time traveled on a mission to kill future human leaders. Blade Runner had to do with cybernetics androids that were revolting against their human masters. Kind of a similar thing between those movies there. And that's the fiction, and you will see how the reality will collide. Okay. Neuralink, it's a company started by Elon Musk in 2016 with seven other founders. And it is supposed to be the answer to the AI, as in his words, possible AI apocalypse. Some of the key facts of the Neuralink companies. It is a privately held company, so no stockholders. It works on implantable brain-computer interfaces, and is based in Fremont, California. And currently holds 35 patents globally in the field of implantable technologies. The Neuralink implant, also known as the Link, is the size of five stack quarters and is placed inside of the brain or on the brain with a specialized machine that Tesla has developed, or not Tesla, but Neuralink has developed for implantation. How does Neuralink work? The first step of the procedure involves the surgeon making a small incision in the scalp. Next, a small hole is drilled into the skull through which the robot, which I do have in a later slide, you guys will see it, inserts electrodes into the brain. These are the size of the thickness of a human hair, And at this point, it's about 1,000 different threads placed at different points in the brain to pick up the neuron signal network. The robot is controlled by a trained professional or surgeon who uses high-resolution imagery to guide the robot, ensures that the electrodes are inserted at the right depth and location within the brain. Once the electrodes have been inserted, they are connected to a small device located behind the ear. This device is responsible for transmitting signals between the electrodes and an external device such as a computer or smartphone. This is the Neuralink surgical robot. The Neuralink robot is designed to minimize the risk of damage to surrounding tissue. During the implantation process, the robot utilizes advanced imaging technology, to create a 3D map of the brain, allowing the surgeon to accurately place the electrodes without damaging any critical parts of the brain. Additionally, the robot is able to adjust its position in real time, ensuring that electrodes are inserted at the right depth and angle. This is important, obviously, because the brain is a complex organ, and different areas of the brain require different levels of stimulation. By accurately placing the electrodes, the Neuralink device is able to provide precise stimulation to desired areas of the brain. There is no current human testing of the Neuralink device, but it is actually been for a couple of years been tested on animals such as chimpanzees and pigs. And I have a picture of one of the star pigs of the experiment currently. Meet Gertrude. This is one of the three little pigs of the Neuralink project. I didn't know I could actually play, I guess, a little bit of the video, but in this experiment, in the demonstration, they actually show accurate readings of the implant and Neuralink being able to play back basically a command and take control of the animal's legs at different points. So, you know, it's pretty amazing. Right. Now down to the brass tacks here. Some of the potential downsides of this technology that's been identified so far is possible brain injury or infection, physical effects such as bleeding, headaches, or nausea or seizures, psychological side effects like mood changes. There can be allergic reaction to implants and materials because they are foreign materials to the body. Movement of implanted threads and wires to other parts of the brain, which could cause unknown effects. And of course, as we're cybersecurity, cybersecurity is an issue because hacking and privacy vulnerabilities may become something that needs to be considered when people can read your brain waves and interface with them. Other unknown long-term effects of the use has not been discovered because no one's been walking around with it so far. Now, I am a glass half full type of guy. Let's go on to the potential rewards. Neuralink's life-changing potential could lead to treatment of mental diseases like Parkinson's, epilepsy, and others. Wearers can control prosthetics and even regain lost motor function. This has been actually demonstrated in some experiments. You can see it on online. Later, Neuralink models will be able to help with hormone regulation and mood issues like anxiety and depression. They're saying it pretty much can solve being in a bad mood, which is pretty amazing.
Lastly, Neuralink can lead to the merging of the human mind and the vast capabilities of cloud computing. So supercharging the mind. Now for the second chapter of this presentation. How does Neuralink and the Tesla bot come together? And we'll get into that. But first I will introduce you to the Tesla bot. Also known as Project Optimus. It's introduced as a concept in 2021. Prototype was actually revealed in 2022, last year, at the AI event at Tesla. The Tesla bot is planned to be a humanoid android that stands about 5'8" and weighing anywhere between 125 pounds to 165 pounds, depending on the model. It's supposed to be powered by a 2.3 kilowatt hour battery pack. And by the Tesla engineer calculations, this should be this should cover a full day's workload for the Tesla bot doing most human-like jobs. And if you're a super technical guy like I am, I do like numbers. They say it averages out to about 100 watts while sitting and 500 watts while walking or performing work. The Tesla bot also has currently Wi-Fi and LTE connectivity. And the AI is a modified version of the system that Tesla puts in their cars. So it's using advanced algorithms. AI algorithms. Now to the third project that Elon Musk is working on. SpaceX and the Starship. SpaceX, which is another company that Elon Musk is also working on, is currently developing its next generation of reusable rockets, dubbed the Starship. The reusable... Sorry, let me change the slide. I apologize. The reusable rocket is designed to carry 150 tons of material or 100 people into orbit and has the capability of refueling in space. The Starship uses a powerful Raptor vacuum engine, which is specifically designed to operate in vacuum space and uses fuels that can be found off-world, i.e. Mars. First flight is supposed to be ready as soon as 2026. Now this is it. This is where I bring it all together. Okay, Mars City. So a lot, most people probably haven't heard of this. Musk has set a grand goal of creating a self-sustaining city on Mars of 1 million people by 2050. He is, by his calculations, stating if we're able to get the space, the Starship up and running on schedule and synchronizing with the closest points of Earth and Mars in 10 orbital synchronizations, which is about a little over 2 years, they could move 1 million people and the support material to get a city up and running by 2050, which is about 22 years. When asked why, because it seems like almost an obsessive project for him,
why would you want to basically spend so much resources and basically do the impossible? Elon Musk says, we're doing this. I think it's in 2022, Starship Progress update. I think this is an incredible thing for the future of life itself. There is always a chance that something could go wrong on Earth. And as an example, dinosaurs are no longer here. So I highlighted kind of three of his major projects to kind of to state that there is like a intertwining, I guess, line of continuity there. Elon Musk thinks that it's in our best interest as a civilization to get off world as soon as possible, get humans into orbit into space and on different planetary bodies, you know, so that we can start working on the problems that we have, such as scarcity. And possibly if there's any planetary catastrophes, there'll at least be humans on other worlds. So I believe that the Neuralink is being designed currently, first stages, of course, to be able to help people with issues as far as walking again, seeing again, things like that. I believe that as it gets more advanced, we work out kinks. There's more approval, of course, from the FDA. We will see that the technology can be used to have the Tesla bot and the Neuralink synchronize, where humans on Earth could possibly control avatars, which we've seen in movies, to have these workers who have the bodies that can work in atmospheres that humans couldn't work in, build up a colony or do off-world mining. And basically, when their shifts are over, they would just log out, as we do in these VR simulations that we have. And I believe that the Tesla bot, with the capabilities of the SpaceX program, he's basically working on all the different factors as far as logistics, production, and also too, I didn't mention this earlier, he also has the capabilities with the network. He has a satellite network that he built up to be able to broadcast a signal to other worlds. So between these, all these companies that he's been working on, which seems kind of like almost the ravings of a madman, almost like Howard Hughes in the old days, I think there's something great that he's working on. So I'm excited for the future. I hope you guys like the presentation. And thank you for listening.
Great job. Stuff for us to think about, right? Lots to worry about with AI starting up.
I didn't know if there was any questions. Sorry, I should have asked. Apologize.
I don't see any in the chat. Does anybody have any questions? All right. Well, you did a great job. That was excellent. You guys are so good at this. Let me tell you.
Thank you, guys.
Let me pull this one up. And yep, Jose's got a good one, too. Oops. I did it again. Hold on. Nope. Take it back. All right, here we go. This was hoping there was narration to this. I don't see any. Oops.
This is a little bit, we are starting from a little bit bigger size as an example.
Okay.
So this is a swallowable cap.
Let me try that again.
This is a little bit, we are starting from a little bit bigger size as an example.
Okay.
So this is a swallowable capsule robot, which has a camera on board, wireless communication, and it has...
It has a camera, you say?
Yes. There's a very tiny camera, the black part. So this, and you see LED
lights. Where is the camera?
It's at the end here.
Okay.
And then there are small magnets inside. As you mentioned, to manipulate anything, you need some physical force. In this case, this capsule has magnets inside, and another external magnet can exert force on this capsule, and inside your body, this can be navigated. So it can roll inside your stomach, it can be stopped, it can go backward and forward. Really? As a robot.
Well, how would you put it in you?
So you swallow it. So it's a pill size.
You swallow it?
So yeah, this is completely wireless robot, as you see in the video. Also, it's made out of a soft material so that it can deform, and it's very safe to use, as you mentioned. Safety is our first rule about the design. And by rolling inside your stomach's tissue surface, the doctor can stop it, and then by controlling the external force, you can indeed eject a drug. Here you see this blue thing.
Oh,
is a
wow,
drug.
It spilled, it made a little pee or something.
Exactly. And it can do this many times. And it can actively image your body so that you can see where you want exactly.
Do it again. Let's see what's it again. But first of all, who is running? It looks like it's got a will. Like, is it being driven by something?
You see that there's an external magnet that the doctor has full control of. And indeed, it's moving outside. Like, you use a magnet outside your body, and it's moving the robot inside your body.
Oh, so there's a doctor outside of you with a magnet, and then there's this little thing wobbling, and so the doctor is moving it.
Exactly. That's why it's safe, so that you don't have any, you know, decision.
Is the doctor squeezing out that blue juice?
Yeah, so doctor says that that area has a disease, so that he or she decides to eject the drug at that point. And also, the same robot can do biopsy, so it can cut some...
Whoa, wait a second. It's a three-in-one. It can take pictures. It can leak, or whatever that is, pour. And it can cut?
Yes.
With what? What is it cutting with?
So the biopsy is a common procedure in GI tract that you want a small piece of your tissue to decide if there is a disease or not. Because sometimes camera images are not sufficient or wouldn't tell you the level of the disease. So doctor needs to take a piece of your tissue and do analysis afterwards. So that we need to pick up this capsule later and do some analysis, which is a little bit dirty.
But wait a second, does it like have a knife in its pocket, or like where is the cutting thing?
It's inside the middle, so it's very safely located, so it doesn't cause any damage. Uh-huh. But as in the drug releasing case, when a doctor controls the force and presses this thing on purpose, the knife comes out and gets a small.
It's like a switchblade.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Whoa. And so you then take a little bit of something and then bring it to the doctor.
Exactly.
How do you, I'm assuming that you bring it to the doctor in the old-fashioned way?
In the biopsy case, yes, you need to pick it up coming out of natural ways. But other cases, we don't pick
That's
it up.
That's the intern does that? Or who?
That's the cost of high technology.
I see.
Okay, wow. That was intense. I was expecting for the rest to be narrated, but my goodness, that was, in your job description, right? Exactly. And it probably would be the intern to take out what needs to be found. So it's always the interns, right? All right. Well, that was kind of incredible. Wow. It kind of fit right into everything that we were talking about tonight. So that works out pretty good. So well, that was, I think, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say it was kind of gross.
It was. Like, interesting, very interesting, that's for sure. Yes.
Yeah, I don't want anything inside me.
You don't want that, no.
No, I mean, but same thing with the thing that goes in your skull and your hand brain
and all that. Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to be controlled by those things.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I'm gonna be the one in control.
No snipping on me, sorry, old school here. My body works just fine, thanks.
Me too. It's like, leave me alone. Let me do my own thing.
Right. Well, thanks everybody for staying this long. I appreciate it. The other ones are probably going to be just as long. But let's see.
Take Anthony, a nap.
You have a question?
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. This is kind of an off-topic question, but it relates to the orientation to invite that I got earlier. I'm in week 5. I didn't have to attend orientation 2 a second time, did I?
No.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
It's automatically sent.
Yeah, it's just because there was everybody's still in orientation. Your name is listed on there. Sometimes it grabs people from other orientations. I mean, it grabs people from the list and it will put it in there just on its own. It's like it puts it in the optional names. Usually I can catch them all, but this time I didn't. Yeah, yeah. You're probably everybody. It's funny because I'll go in there and I'll have to take them out. But I didn't catch it this time. We do. We still have interns trickling in. So keep your eyes out for department additions. But I want to thank you for everybody, you know, holding out this long. This was a long one, couple hours. But you know what? It was so interesting. I got a lot done in the meantime as well. But man, these are good, everybody. You're doing such a great job on these presentations. I'm telling you, you just keep getting better and better. So big congratulations to getting those done. And I look forward to next week already. Yep, great job. Thanks, everybody. Have a great night and a great weekend.
Good night. Talk to
all you guys soon.
Have fun. Well, not too much fun.